What is up, you grizzled heads? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back this week with our So You're Going to See Shakespeare episode. The idea of these episodes is that it's something that you'll listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see Antony and Cleopatra.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into the episode is a quick synopsis of the play so you at least know the story. Dan, take it away.
Sure. So, the show opens with rumors in the street that Antony hasn't been fulfilling his duty as Triumvir of Rome because he's out at all hours painting the town red with Cleopatra, the Queen of the Nile. During one of his dalliances, he gets word that Fulvia, his wife, has died. Cleopatra is not too broken up about this news. This is a rude awakening for Antony, however, who realizes he needs to get back to Rome to fulfill his political obligations. Cleopatra likes this news significantly less.
Back in Rome, the other two triumvirs, Lepidus and Octavius Caesar, bitch about how Antony keeps showing up on, like, TMZ, when he would be really useful in preparing Rome to take on the dangerous naval fleet of the pirate Pompey. While Pompey prepares to strike, Antony comes home and reconciles his differences with Octavius by agreeing to marry his sister, Octavia. Cleopatra does not like this news one bit.
The triumvirs and Pompey hold a parley and are able to negotiate a peace. With the paperwork in place, they decide to party, and everyone gets absolutely hammered. At the party, Pompey's sidekick, Minos, points out that Pompey could easily assassinate all three parts of the triumvirate in one fell swoop. Pompey tells him that would be a dick move and that he should relax.
The triumvirate promptly turns on and kills Pompey. Oops.
Octavia and Antony leave Rome for Athens. But Antony keeps feeling slighted by Octavius' actions back home, including but not limited to his ouster of Lepidus, leaving just Antony and he as the leaders of Rome. Antony sends his wife Octavia back to serve as a conciliator between the two of them. And as soon as she heads out, he rushes to Egypt where he and Cleopatra name themselves Emperors of the Orient. As the kids say, it is now officially on between Antony and Octavius.
Antony and Octavius line up to do battle, and Octavius goads Antony into fighting on the sea, where Antony is at a huge disadvantage. Octavius promptly kicks the shit out of him, culminating in Cleopatra, who had a ship of her own in the battle, bailing, and Antony chasing her rather than sticking around to help lead the rest of his fleet. Later on, Antony begs his soldiers for forgiveness for his hasty retreat, then invites them to a great feast so they can all have one last time together before the war's upcoming major battles. Antony then goes on to win the first of those major battles, but is destroyed in the second and thinks it's the result of Cleopatra's betrayal. He vows to kill her.
Cleopatra sends fake news that she has killed herself to slow Antony. Dishonest! When he hears the news, he resolves to die himself. Sad. He begs his second to kill him, but when he won't, Antony has no choice but to fall on his own sword. Unfortunately, he doesn't kill himself.
Just missed.
Whoops. And he is brought bleeding to Cleopatra.
Because he has not killed him, he has not finished the deed, Antony and Cleopatra are able to share last words and a final kiss before he dies.
Upon hearing news of Antony's death and Cleopatra's capture, Octavius sends a soldier to tell Cleopatra that he will do her no harm. The soldier, however, captures Cleopatra to ensure that she doesn't kill herself.
Octavius and Cleopatra then meet and just go ahead and lie to each other's faces, with Octavius saying he'll treat her with the greatest respect, spoiler, won't, Cleopatra saying that she's looking forward to it, spoiler, she isn't. Upon learning that Caesar is actually planning to display her as a trophy of war, Cleopatra is able to sneak some snakes into her chamber and, allowing them to bite her, she dies. And that is... Antony and Cleopatra.
Wow.
Now that you know what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where Antony and Cleopatra falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written. Daniel.
Yes. So Antony and Cleopatra was written in 1606. So before launching too far into anything on this section, if you have time in your car ride to see the show, there's a Barnes & Noble on the way. Stop and pick up the Year of Lear and just crush that on your way in. Friend of the podcast, Jim Shapiro, does a great job explaining everything that happens in this year. But for some highlights, this is the year of, we know that it's coming fresh off of Macbeth and Lear. So it's a big year for Shakespeare. A lot of huge characters. If you look at the role of Antony, Macbeth, and Lear, we're talking about three sort of huge parts in the canon and monster men. And we know this is early on in James's reign. So this still has that sense of creating massive male leaders, I suppose, is a really interesting Shakespeare's phase of his career this year.
It's interesting, the female characters in those three plays, too. Lady Mac, Cleopatra, and then the sisters in Lear.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Tying further into the fact that this is immediately subsequent to Macbeth, there's a line in Macbeth in 3-1 that is the Elizabethan equivalent of a post-credit scene in a Marvel superhero movie, where Macbeth says to him, I believe it's Macbeth has the line, "Under him my genius is rebuked, as it is said Mark Antony's was by Caesar," which is like, oh, I heard he was working on Antony. Is that a teaser?
That's a teaser.
Is he writing that?
That's coming out, I think, in the summer break.
So that's, you know, when you see Macbeth, you can see that tease, that big market tease by Billy Shakes about the incoming Antony. This is one of Shakespeare's longest plays. When you look at Richard III, Hamlet, Coriolanus, and Cymbeline are the only ones longer. And possibly, in related news, there is actually a possibility that this play was never performed in Shakespeare's lifetime, as there is no record of any performances.
Really?
There are, you know, whereas all these other ones, they've at least found, you know, ledgers of payments being made for productions or whatever. Right. There is no such record. That's not to say it didn't happen, because they don't have the records for every production, but there is the possibility that he wrote this and was like, I don't think this is going to work.
Interesting. It's funny that we know for a fact in 1608, publisher Edward Blunt acquired the rights for the work, but possibly as literature, and he acquired it as a two-part package. So he got A and C, and also picked up in the deal Pericles. So I guess it's like, what, you got to throw in Mike Lowell to
that
get
was
Beckett?
A PTBNL, a play to be named later.
That's right.
It ended up being Pericles. The main source of this play was Plutarch's Parallel Lives of the Greeks and Romans, which was written in the first century and then translated to English in 1579 by Sir Thomas North. So Shakespeare would have been familiar with this book from his relative youth. And he clearly liked it, because this same book serves as the source for Midsummer, Caesar, Timon, and Coriolanus, in addition to A and C.
Good purchase.
Yeah, a lot of notes in that book.
That's awesome.
On the margins.
And again, for some context, just how long ago this play was written. This is also the same year that the first version of the Union flag was created. For
the Union Jack.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So just a reminder, they didn't even have a flag at this point. They had Antony and Cleopatra. So that's pretty impressive.
So there you go. That is a little idea of what Shakespeare's world was like at the time this play was first written. This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play, and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites, and I'm going to pick mine of those three for us to dig in on. So Dan, what are our finalists?
So the finalists for Miss Best Theme in Antony and Cleopatra are transformation, honor, and public obligation versus personal desire.
Yeah, we're definitely going to do that third one. Public obligation versus personal desire.
Yes.
So the most obvious example of this, obviously, is Antony and Cleopatra's relationship, where Antony is, you know, keeps running back to Cleopatra, even though he knows it's politically and in his role as a leader is not only the wrong thing to do, but actively harmful to Rome.
Sure.
Just because, you know, he in that triumvirate, he's the warrior, he's the soldier.
Yeah.
You know, even though Octavius is also a soldier and a pretty efficient soldier, but I don't picture Octavius is dropping any once more into the breach speeches.
Right.
You know, he's like, once more, 30% of the military will move in from the left, and then, you know, it's like, okay,
more
we get
a tactician.
Yeah, exactly. We get it, Octavius. there's a little bit of this with Cleopatra in that she's, you know, she's infatuated with Antony as much as Antony is infatuated with her, but she has no, they're not moving towards, you know, looking at it in the royal way of getting married to establish a dynasty, to, you know, unite, using marriage as a political tool like was done in this time. They're not moving towards marriage. They just can't keep their hands off of each other. So for both, it's equally damaging for both of them.
Do you think that she would be upset if he was like, hey, let's screw the world and get married?
I don't know. And unite Rome and Egypt? I mean, yeah. I think they just can't.
Okay.
You know, I think they know.
There's something interesting in the fact that the Antony that she describes and the Antony we see in the play are not the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes me wonder a little bit more about the personal desire. Like, what happens between the public and private?
Yeah.
Who does she see behind closed doors?
Yeah.
And who is he for the people that he leads?
Right.
Which is a nice little difference between public and private.
Yeah, and I think that at the other end of this spectrum is Octavius, who pretty clearly is doing the right, you know, in terms of what he does in his personal life, is dedicated, no matter what it means to him personally, to do the right thing politically, because he marries his sister to a scumbag that he knows is like 90% sure is going to run back to Cleopatra.
Right.
And, you know, if you were cynical, you can look at this cynically or optimistically if he's optimistic, as we always do. If you were optimistic, you'd say, well, he'll marry my sister. She's the best. Then that'll keep him here at home.
Right.
If you're pessimistic, you say, I'll marry her to my sister. He's going to go back to Cleopatra, and then I'm going to destroy him. I know this is going to happen, and that is going to be the linchpin of how this is going to fall apart.
I like that one.
I'm
like
shocked.
One. Also, as an interesting tidbit, this is the only Roman play which has no public scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does, I think that's Shakespeare just reminding you, hey, this is a play about a relationship, mm-hmm. not about Rome. If you want like a play about politics in Rome, I did that already.
That's covered.
So, but this is about two people.
Right.
It's a private relationship.
Right. And if you go down the line, you know, professional versus personal, you look at the relationship that all the messengers have with Cleopatra, where it's like, it's their job to go give Cleopatra this bad news, and they all know they're going to get smacked around.
Right, just beaten up.
But they do it. Like, couldn't you just say, like, I lost it?
That's their public obligation.
Right? It's like, I'm sorry, my name is Messenger, so I have to do this.
Messenger. I'm here. Why couldn't you give me a first name, please?
You know, between that and the soldier that that Antony asked to kill him. Yeah, I think there's a lot of that where people are, or how about Enobarbus leaving Antony because he knows that it's over.
Right.
That, you know, Antony has been eliminated from playoff contention at that point. You know, and that's something that grieves him deeply personally, but professionally, as in... is in, you know, a big part of the profession of being a soldier is not getting your goddamn head chopped off.
Correct.
It's time to switch.
Trade deadline. You know, Barbara's got moved for some prospects.
Exactly.
Perfect.
Yeah, so that is the theme to keep an eye out for. What was it again?
Public obligation versus personal desire.
Keep an eye out for it when you go out to see Antony and Cleopatra. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. I won the coin flip before the show, and I've elected to go first, so here we go. I think there are a lot of characters in this play. There sure are. Lots of characters.
Lots of characters.
But I think the one that the show stealer in this one is Pompey the pirate.
Oh, nice.
I think that would be the most fun. You know, that Pompey is the guy that looks at the strife within the triumvirate and is like, now's my time. Your time is up. My time is now. And he goes in and he goes to war. Like, not a lot of independent contractors that decide to go after Rome.
Right.
And he's up to do it. And he goes in and he has this great, that scene where they have the parley, where it's the three triumvirs pretending everything's good and Pompey being like, I have eyes and I get the Inquirer. So like, I know what's going on here. So you have that scene where he gets to be just a certified anti-hero badass.
Yeah.
And he looks the triumvirate. He looks Rome dead in the eye and doesn't blink.
Awesome.
It's awesome.
And gets killed.
And then in that next scene where he gets to actually be, you show that he's, I mean, this is actually not something that traditionally is necessary for my interest in a role, but in the next scene he shows that he's actually a pretty decent dude.
Time to act.
when it's like, you could be the king, and he's like, nah, man, that's not cool. And then you get to, you know, I don't, let's just put it this way. Since, you know, this is an intensely personal question, these are very arbitrary reasons that we do these,
yes,
that we choose these. Not a lot of times I get to be a tragic hero.
Pompey, tragic hero.
He's tragic. I don't know if he's a hero.
I'll concede the tragic.
not a lot of sympathy being sent my way in the roles that I traditionally would want to or are able to play.
That is fair.
And so this is probably the only, this might be the only Venn diagram moment of
pirate. Parts.
Right? yeah. So that's what I would like. I would like to play Pompey the Pirate.
What a water rat you are. So for this one, since Antony and Cleopatra are both off the big board for me, which is devastating, two roles I could crush.
Oh God!
I will go, and this is, I think, something I haven't done on this bit, but I like this. This is a play I'm not dying to be in.
Okay,
I look at the audition sheet, I'm like, nope, I'm busy.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to be, I think I'd try to pitch the director on this concept.
Oh Jesus!
And cast, I'd like to play the soothsayer.
Okay,
and the clown. In a double role.
Yeah, I buy that.
And just come in for like 45 lines, you know, just do the bit as a soothsayer, get like two acts off,
uh-huh.
Go to the bar, get a drink, sure. Come back, be like, give me the basket of snakes, I'm going out there. And that clown is creepy.
Oh, it's weird.
It's a really weird role. So maybe in a season, like it's in rep with something,
yeah.
Where I have a bigger part in the other play, as mm-hmm. like we're doing Twelfth Night in A&C in the same season, because mm-hmm. you have a great boat. We could do, like, I'll play Feste and then just show up as, like, this creepo with a bucket of snakes.
Interesting.
And also the soothsayer, just like, sort of this guy who's like, ah, shit, it's that guy.
Yeah.
And just, like, creep in.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be, like, symbols and happy clown. Just like, hey, it's me. The worm's going to have his day.
Yeah.
Like, I love that part. And there's so much good text in here, but something, when reading it, I was like, oh, yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
I see me in there. So... In a twist of fate, I won't play the lead this time. I'm happy to deign to play the soothsayer and the clown.
It's very kind of you.
How kind of me?
There you go. Those are our roles. Let us know what your favorite would be after you go out to see this production of Antony and Cleopatra. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from the play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it. The line we chose from Antony and Cleopatra is, "It is my birthday," from Act 3, Scene 13. Let's hear the phrase in context.
To flatter Caesar, would you mingle eyes with one that ties his points?
Not know me yet?
Cold-hearted toward me?
Ah, dear, if I be so, from my cold heart let heaven engender hail and poison it in the source, and the first stone drop in my neck, as it determines so dissolve my life. The next Caesarian smite, till by degrees the memory of my womb, together with my brave Egyptians, all by the discandying of this pelleted storm lie graveless, till the flies and gnats of Nile have buried them for prey.
I am satisfied. Caesar sits down in Alexandria, where I will oppose his fate. Our force by land hath nobly held. Our severed navy, too, have knit again, and fleet threatening most sea-like. Where hast thou been, my heart? Dost thou hear, lady? If from the field I shall return once more to kiss these lips, I will appear in blood. I and my sword will earn our chronicle. There's hope in't yet.
That's my brave lord.
I will be treble-sinewed, hearted, breathed, and fight maliciously. For when mine hours were nice and lucky, men did ransom lives of me for jests. But now I'll set my teeth and send to darkness all that stop me. Come. Let's have one other gaudy night. Call to me all my sad captains. Fill our bowls once more. Let's mock the midnight bell.
It is my birthday. I had thought to have held it poor, but since my lord is Antony again, I will be Cleopatra.
We will yet do well.
Call all his noble captains to my lord.
Do so. We'll speak to them. And tonight I'll force the wine peep through their scars. Come on, my queen. There's sap in yet. The next time I do fight, I'll make death love me. For I will contend even with his pestilent scythe.
So that is, it is my birthday from Act 3, Scene 13. So, for, right?
Excuse me, what was that?
Scene 13, yeah.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah, stack them up. So for a little context on this, we have Antony has just been smacked around two or three times by Octavius. And he, Octavius, after winning these battles, sends a messenger to Cleopatra saying basically like, hey, it's not looking great for your, for your boy. So why don't you just come over on our side? We'll take care of you. You know, we'll honor you and we won't, also we won't execute you as a traitor to Rome. How's that?
Nice.
And so Cleopatra like flirts with the messenger and she's like throwing some Cleopatra game at him.
Yep.
And Antony comes in and sees it and is displeased. Right. And so this scene starts with him saying like, you're going to make eyes at a
squid booty.
Exactly. Precisely. Right. That's First Folio.
Right.
And so in this scene, she's like, no, I was, you know, I mean, depending on the actress can play it however she wants, whether she actually was or if she's like, no, I was setting him up to get you riled up, you know. And then over the course of this scene, Mark Antony turns from like a beaten, sad old man to the point where he's like, oh, no, wait, I'm Mark Antony. Call up the boys. We're getting wrecked, and tomorrow we're smashing skulls. So right. That's the arc of this. But the reason this is one of my favorite. This is my favorite. I think the goosebumpiest moment in the play. This is another one in the line. You know, this really couldn't be a everyday shakes.
Because it is my birthday.
Because you're right, exactly. It doesn't really stand on its own.
You can use it one day of the year.
Right? It's a one day a year shakes.
Right.
But it's in this scene. It can be so goosebumpy, or it could be just steamrolled or cut. You know.
Right. Right.
But I just the moment of, you know, they're so Mark Antony's going to kill her. Like, this is, he's already said he's going to kill her in a previous scene.
Yeah.
Now he's coming in real hot, and Cleopatra's like, honey, it's only act three, so.
But it's scene 13!
But they come in at this, just such a fever pitch that the two of them seem to like to operate at.
Yeah.
And they're so infatuated with each other that Cleopatra just forgets until this moment where she's like, wait, there's something to celebrate.
Right,
like,
now, right.
It's almost like she's looking backwards through her whole, you know, I always say about this play that Romeo and Juliet is a play about first love.
Yeah.
Antony and Cleopatra is a play about last love.
Yes.
And I think her saying it is her birthday is both like she kind of forgot until right now, but also in saying that line, let's put it this way, it ain't her first birthday and it ain't her 30th birthday. I actually don't know how old she is, but she's older.
Right.
And when she says it's her birthday, she's taking that moment to look back at all of her previous birthdays and all the previous men, including Julius Caesar, that she's spent time with. And yet here she is with Mark Antony.
Right.
This Mark Antony. Not the Mark Antony she's rallying him to be now.
Right, right, right.
But like, this is still where she is. And I wonder if she wonders if this is her last birthday.
It's quite possible, right?
You know?
It's this interesting in Julius Caesar, Cassius has a very similar line where he is basically resolved to die.
Mm-hmm.
And his line is, it is my birthday.
Huh.
The time has come around. Forget the second part of it. But he has the exact same, it is my birthday. The revelation of like, wow, here I am. Didn't think this is how I'd celebrate.
Yeah.
But there's something to extend the goosebumps, conspiracy theories. Talked a little bit about soothsayers before, and if you've watched that documentary Shakespeare in Love, you know that Shakespeare went to a soothsayer. The hit musical Something Rotten, a soothsayer plays a big part. There's something cryptic about the fact that Shakespeare dies on his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And in two of his plays he references characters who are like, well,
birthday.
Wow.
Not the best day of the world.
I literally have goosebumps
right now. You do?
Right
I see
now.
Them.
Yeah. I never thought about that. That right? is goosebump central.
That's it.
So there you go.
I had other things to say, but I think we'll leave it with the goosebumps.
Yeah, right? I mean, literal goosebumps. It's like Dave Roberts just stole a second. So there you go. Woo! That is, it is my birthday. Keep an ear out for you when you go out to see the show. Here, we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For Antony and Cleopatra, we think the biggest challenge is the stage direction. Canidius marcheth with his land army one way over the stage, and Taurus, the lieutenant of Octavius Caesar, the other way, after they're going in, is heard the noise of a sea fight. In Act 3, Scene 10, which kind of reads like our homework questions. It's like, right. Who wrote this?
What? What is this?
So, for, you know, it's this is one of the biggest, the real biggest challenge with this play is there is so much action that takes place off stage.
Right.
Particularly military action.
Right. And shifting locations. Mm-hmm. The military action is like, wait, where are we now?
Right. And they're
boom, 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 boom.
Right. There are multiple fronts and there are like 40 different soldiers. Yeah. And then there are a lot of parts of it where, like, Enobarbus is like, whoa, would you look at that? He's winning. It's like that scene in Wet Hot American Summer where he's watching, Neil is watching Victor save the kids, but they don't show him saving the kids. They just show Neil being like, he's doing it. He's saving them.
Is that the first folio?
That's the first folio, Wet Hot American Summer.
Of course,
of course. But, you know, if you're going to wonder about reasons why this might not have been staged in Shakespeare's time, I think this is it, that they were like,
that's interesting.
Bill. You have four scenes in a row that are just sea battles.
Hey, man. I'm doing them what? I'm not sure at this point. It's 1606, baby.
Right? I'm not selling out.
I just did Macbeth.
Right?
Just like I did Lear. Do what I want.
I want a sea battle, damn it.
I don't know why Shakespeare's a chain smoker in this iteration.
I love it. I buy it. So it's a real challenge in these productions that you need to have something in these, like, I think there's another stage direction somewhere else where it's like a guy has a line and it's like, okay, cool. And then the stage direction is a sea battle.
Yeah.
It's like, sure. How the hell are we going to do that?
Sea battle.
The only, I think I've only seen one production.
I've only seen one as well.
Yeah. And in that production, there was puppets. There was a shadow. It was the upstage was a shadow.
Did you just
puppet.
Call the actors?
Just moving shadows upon a stage. It was so they had all the scenes in shadow puppets.
Oh, sure.
Upstage.
Yep.
It kind of works.
It's a solution, right? It's a solution.
Yeah.
I think, well, I know we've talked a little bit about your thoughts on some things you could do in the modern era that could solve this problem.
Yeah.
My big point is actually a response to your modern point.
Should I make my point?
That would be great.
Okay,
so
cool.
So I can hop in and counterpoint.
So here. I think that there is, this may have been a play that's been waiting 400 years to be staged, because I think using audiovisual, multimedia projections, film, works best in this play than it would in any play in the canon. This lends itself so well. Yeah. You know, even the fact that there is such a divide between Antony and Cleopatra's public life, which is so public, like bordering, like the first scene basically starts with two paparazzi being like, can you believe this?
Right.
That it would be very easy to incorporate some sort of video element into this. And then that would be very useful in these scenes where, you know, these sea battles, you could just throw them up.
Yeah.
Just have scenes and you can watch these battles and you can watch the people watching these battles.
Right.
So that's what I think this can be solved now. It's just if any director cares enough to do so.
And has the budget for
and
all the
has
video.
The budget. Yeah, right. Of course.
So yeah, what I think is interesting about the hang-ups on how do you make this work, I think that's actually very modern thought. Uh-huh. The audience nowadays needs that sort of spectacle. Whereas I think in 1606, we're talking about Blackfriars being open. This is probably one of Shakespeare's first plays written for indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was experimenting. I think that part of it is just like, it was just straight episodic scenes that were short because he was in an indoor intimate theater, and it was all, the imagination was actually more powerful.
Huh.
He had the audience's focus in a way that he hadn't ever had before.
That's interesting.
So he could actually just put it on the words. And they would fill it all in. Like, I imagine they were using a lot more imagination than we, as a modern audience, let ourselves do. But I think that's also why you have 13 scenes in an act.
Right.
It's because we're indoors, so it's all candlelit. So you have to go until the candles are out
to switch the act. Huh. So if you have all these short scenes, like, well, I need like four more before the candles are out, and it's not a time where you can just like, yeah, screw it. We'll just waste those candles. Just throw those away. It's like, nope. You got to go with the candle length. Like,
yeah.
You got to go the right. whole way.
And
buddy.
Then you can stretch out the sea battle however they did it.
Right.
It's like, how much, what do we need? 2 more minutes in this act?
The ref's in there like, yeah, we need 3 more spots.
All right, sea battle. What do you want? What do you want in this sea battle? I want 2 minutes of it is what I want.
Just vamp.
Maybe
just
you're just tired.
Just watch the candles.
Right? Just move around. Put on your boat costume and dance around.
Do you hear what Shakespeare's doing at the Blackfriars? There's sea battles everywhere.
Really?
Yeah, you gotta go check it out. Joke's on you, Elizabethans.
Always be disappointed by sea battles. So there you go. Let us know how the director handles all of this stuff in the production that you're going to see. So that's going to do it for this episode of So You're Going to See Antony and Cleopatra. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us in iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can Patreon us at patreon.com/noholdsbarred. You can tweet us at No Holds Bardcast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com/ No Holds Bardcast. Until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bollier.
And then to Rome. Come, Dolabella, see.
High order in this great solemnity.
Adieu, 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 adieu.